everybody. It's John Marks, the editor of CopsAlive.com. I want to welcome you to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. I'm very excited about our program today and our guest. Our guest today is John Southworth. He is an expert on addiction, recovery, and intervention. He is the president of Southworth Associates, and he does an awful lot to help cops who are suffering from various problems, and I want him to tell you about that. Welcome, John. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for asking me, John.
It is my pleasure. I'm honored to have you here. Let's start with maybe just having you give us a little bit of background about yourself. Tell us your story, and then we'll go from there.
Well, thank you. It all started in January 1st. I like to start everything out the first of the year. I was a New Year's baby, born in Cajun County, Oakley, Idaho, in 1938. First baby born in Cajun County, and we won a ton of coal. We were burning oil and won a bunch of dresses, and I was a guy, and it kind of went downhill from there, John. But I came from an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic, and his father was an alcoholic. Wow. They were all compulsive gamblers and alcoholics. And as I look back now, and the best I can put back is my great-grandfather, who brought the first flour mill to Idaho, John Southworth. He died, we think, around 82 years of age of alcoholism. Then my grandfather, who owned the flour mills in Oakley, he died at 72 of alcoholism. Then my dad died of alcoholism at 63. His younger brother died of a heart attack, heavy drinker, probably alcoholism too, at the age of 55, and his wife died of an overdose at the age of 40. So our family was pretty well wiped out by this disease of addiction. I was raised in a very comfortable home, except for the drinking, but it was very normal to me. Yeah. And my dad drank. When we moved from Oakley, Idaho, the first year in 1938 to Boise, Idaho, so my dad could get a job, my mother protected me. She'd never been around alcohol, and her family was Mormon and didn't drink. And my dad's family was Mormon, but they did drink. And she was not accustomed to this, so she was trying to protect me. And she told me that my dad loved me, but he was really busy working so we could have this nice apartment. So, you know, World War II came, and I was raised with fear and lots of manipulation about fear. You know, if you don't behave, you know what's going to happen when your dad comes home. And he's been dead 37 years, and I still don't know what's going to happen when my dad comes home. That was the fear that they gave me. So I grew up as a child of an alcoholic, or an adult child of an alcoholic, which I am now. And I started out school in Whitney Grade School in Boise. At the first grade, around 6 years of age. And another thing happened. My sister was born. So all of a sudden, my sister, excuse me, has taken my place of me at home with my mom, who I love so much, very attached to, didn't care much about my dad, scared of him. And he would come home drunk sometimes. To be able to manipulate me, he'd get drunk, and he had a hairy chest, and he used to light the hair on his chest on fire and say, if you don't behave, this is what I'm going to do, is burn myself up. And it scared the hell out of me. So it was kind of an odd family, but I didn't think it was. I thought everybody was like that. But I went to grade school, got good grades, and didn't like it because my sister Linda, she was home and in my new place, and all the people who used to come over and tell me how cute I was were now coming over and talking about this new baby. So I felt really abandoned. So I really had trouble with women. I've never been married, and I never been in a real good relationship as far as intimacy. I don't know anything about it. I never saw it. Mom and Dad never hugged, so I didn't have any tools. 6 years later, my sister Mary was born, and there were 6 years between us. And I got good grades and got into high school, and then we moved from back to Oakley, from Boise, where I was getting A's, and went back to Oakley, where I was born. My dad took over the flour mill, and I was introduced to tobacco, and here came the beer, and all of a sudden, I'm smoking and drinking, and the grades go from straight A's down to B's and F's, and I didn't think it was anything, because, you know, the seniors were drinking, and they were getting me booze, and I was having a good time, and I finally fit. I was such a loner before that. I never fit. I wasn't a good athlete, and you know, I was one of those guys where they said, okay, we'll take those three girls, but you got to take John. And that always made me feel good. So I was never really an athlete, so quite a loner. And I had a tough time in school after I started drinking. They used to let school out for 2 weeks at a time to pick potatoes and made a little money with the potatoes. Mine all went for booze. And I finally made it through high school. My English teacher, Mrs. Stroud, told my folks, if you don't let John into English, I'll let him graduate. So I finally graduated, and I went to Idaho State University to become a pharmacist. And I was there in 1956, and I was out partying one night. We hit a tree, and we scalped three little girls. We all ended up in the hospital, and I came back home, didn't finish college, and from drinking, and got a job driving truck with my uncle, hauling frozen French fries across the United States. It was kind of we had a sleeper double cab, and I was a young guy driving these French fries when they first started in the 50s. And we would drink about a six-pack to get to sleep in that sleeper so we could sleep. And so my drinking continued. And one night in Burley, Idaho, where the French fry factory was, I took my trailer down to get it loaded. And besides my trailer getting loaded, so did I. I went up to, I bought a new white 59 Chevrolet convertible. And I thought, maybe this will slow me down. And I went up to get a drink. And while they're loading my trailer with fries, and went into the pilot's club, and Pep Salasabal was the bartender, and he said, we'd like to have a drink. And I said, well, I hadn't better. I got to pull it out in the morning about 1. He said, well, you can have one. I said, yeah. One's for too many, and 1,000 wasn't enough. Pretty soon I'm drunk. Mm-hmm. And so Pep said, I don't want you driving that new Chevrolet convertible out there. And I had the top down, and it was snowing, of course. So he said, you better give me the keys. So, you know, I'm not an alcoholic, so I gave him the keys. And he said, you better take a cab home. So I did. But I failed to bring the driver. I just took the cab and drove it home. The keys were in it. So the guy was in getting a cup of coffee. So when I got out of jail the next morning, I'd lost that job, too. So I seemed to wouldn't be able to hold a job very well. So in the meantime, my folks moved to Caldwell. My dad got a job at Kit Manufacturing, and I followed him up there. I got a job with Les Summers, who was a peach of a man. I just loved Les. And was a good salesman, really good salesman. Had a good personality, funny, and really did well in the store. But then he made a mistake. He let me out as an outside salesman. And I went outside as a salesman selling typewriters and office equipment to the different schools and offices. And then I started taking little trips to Reno and Winnemucca and not coming back. So I lost that job. Then I went to work in Jordan Valley, Oregon, herding cows and working for Board and Room. And then my drinking got involved, and I lost that job. And so I ended up finally getting a job with a company out of Chicago called Speedo Print Business Machines. And Abe Samuels was a guy that liked me and gave me this job, and I toured the western states selling office supplies to distribute them to office furniture stores and office supply stores. Did really well, except I could only work every other day because I'd get drunk, and then I'd be okay the next day, and then get drunk the next day. And it finally got so bad, of course, they had to fire me. And so I lost that job. And then I went to work in Los Angeles, and I lost that job. And then I started running on stolen credit cards. We were buying stolen credit cards, running on those, anything to survive. And I was traveling on them, and we got busted, and my friends got busted, and we started sinking boats and got busted, and people were on to us. And finally, we all scattered, and one of my friends went to Central America, and I went back to Boise. And my uncle, Don, before he died in 1972, he said, you know that office supply business? He said, I'll back you and your dad, and you start an office supply store. But he said, you got to do something about that drinking. So 1972 in August, I left Los Angeles, went back to Boise, and started Southworth Discount Stationers. And my dad was the accountant, and he would go next door drinking and playing cards, and I'd get drunk, and we're having a hell of a time trying to get that store open. Finally got it open in August, and that's about the time inflation took off. And boy, did we grow fast. And I took off as a good salesman, got some big accounts, Hewlett-Packard, Morrison, Knudsen, Albertsons. We were doing great. And we had 7 stores in less than 8 years, and the interest rates went from about 6.25% up to 21.5%, and I'm borrowing about $1.5 million trying to keep that thing going, smoking a lot of pot, drinking, And finally, on July 30th, 1980, the bank moved in. I couldn't make those payments without high interest, plus all the smoke or all the marijuana I was smoking and drinking and all the other stuff. So I lost the corporation, doing about $10 million a year, had 136 employees, and I had 38 cars and trucks. And man, they came in and wiped me out, and I was gone. All to do with alcohol and drugs. I picked up 8 drunk driving charges, of which I always talk about that had nothing to do with alcohol. It was very poor legal representation, but that's not quite the truth. But alcoholics seem to lie. And I had all these DUIs, and I still can't get into Canada because of my record of DUIs. And I started in the cocaine business, and I started dealing coke. And I started that in 80, smoking more grass, in and out of the cocaine. And finally, my partner, he and I, Harry, he was my purchasing agent at Salvers. He and I were dealing drugs, and he got popped, and the cops came in and busted him. And then I got caught myself, and they said that if I would testify that, that I wasn't doing that, and they'd let me go. And it was the police department that came in and saved my life. And I told the cops a lot about that, how they saved my life. If it hadn't been for that intervention, I'd probably be dead. But back as soon as I quit the office, before I started the office supply business, I had to go to treatment. In 1972, I went to Raleigh Hills in Portland, Oregon. And that was the aversion treatment. And you sat in this chair, and you drank and got sick, drank and got sick, drank and got sick, drank and got sick, and it was terrible. It was in a straitjacket. If you ever see the movie One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, that was me. And I came out of there, never to drink again, and went right to marijuana. And that took me up through the office supply stage. And then when I lost that due to marijuana and pills, and then I was done, and then went into the cocaine business, then got busted with Harry. And so that was the end of that career. And I finally went back into treatment again, and I went, that year of 82, I went into treatment 4 times. And I, in and out, and trying to go to AA, trying to go to NA, and nothing was working for me. Well, I wasn't dedicated to it, that's for sure. Finally, the last time in, the treatment center said, you can't come back anymore. And that was pretty devastating to me. So I started going to NA and then to AA, 12-step meetings, I should say. And I got really involved, became part of it instead of a part from. And then I changed addictions. I went from alcohol and drugs. I tried to have a sobriety date of January 1st, 1983. And I find that with addicts that there's people usually tell us we've got a mental health problem, and I think it's because of our behavior for using the alcohol and drugs. And the next addiction to pop up was, of course, food. And then I gained an awful lot of weight, about 80 pounds. And in the last 4 years, I've been able to get it back off. But I've been sober 30 years now. But it's quite a rocky road getting into recovery. I go to a lot of 12-step meetings. When I first got out, I was very cautious. I was very scared. I had everything repossessed, so I rode a bus. And in 1992, I did go back and get my counselor's certification, a DUI evaluator, and did a lot of what they call 12-stepping and 12-step programs, helping other alcoholics and drug addicts. And I liked doing that. I liked helping other people. And I thought maybe this is my calling. In 1992, the state of Idaho wanted the Idaho Medical Association wanted to someone to run their program for doctors who might have an alcohol, drug, or mental health problem. And I applied for it and got it. So for the past 21 years, I've been running that program, and our success rate is fantastic. And then I got the pharmacists, and I got the nurses, and I got the dentists, and dental hygienists, and veterinarians just come on board here. And so now we got all these programs, and we're doing a good job. We're intervening on them. And we're putting them in treatment, and we're monitoring them for 5 years. And the success rate is fantastic. Right now, the pharmacists, I've only had them for 3 years, and I've got 100% track record with them. We're really happy about that. We got the doctors up about 76% now, and I got on the boards with these Federation of State Physicians Health Program. So with these great records that we got, I started looking at it, and the normal person, like my poor friends, the cops, their recovery rate, if we could ever find them, because they go underground with their drinking and their drugging, and they were dying. They were blowing their heads off. They were dying. And so with the track record, Faith Call Now approached me, and they said, the FBI Academy and ourselves would like to know how you're doing this. And I showed them my record. And so I said, the biggest thing is put them in treatment long enough, which is 12 weeks, and then monitor them for 5 years, case manage them for 5 years. Mm-hmm. It's just like cancer. If you can get 5 years of clean time on cancer, you've got a pretty good prognosis for recovery. So I said, but the big thing is with the Board of Medicine or an airline pilot or a nurse or something, there's always that license that if you don't do this, this is what's going to happen to you. There's consequences. So when people are coming out of treatment, I take the discharge summary, I take the recommendations from the treatment center, the good treatment centers, and get them the longest term you can because it's a brain disease, it's incurable. And I said, let's get them in long-term treatment. So the FBI Academy says, this is what we want. We want good track record. So we start training the cops. I've been to undercover with the FBI. I've been just did Palm Bay in Florida with their cops and their firemen. And they really caught on to this. But our biggest problem is just exactly what we had with the doctors back in 86 when we first started that volunteer program for the docs, is getting them out from under the rocks. And cops are very proud, and their buddies are drinking. And if you got this disease, and it's a genetic disease, it's handed down, they don't have any control over their drinking. And they got to go underground with it. And what we're trying to do is to be able to help these poor guys before they commit suicide or get in some kind of a mess at work or whatever, save their lives, their jobs, their families. And I think the biggest thing we got to do is to, when we see a sign, and I've said this on a tape I've got, is when you see a red light on the dashboard of a car, then you take it in and you get it fixed. We don't do that with humans. There's changes that go on with a human are changes of behavior, attitude, achievement, and attendance. When you got that going on, if we get the backing of the brotherhoods and the police departments, the chiefs and everybody else, that it's okay to have a disease of addiction, then they'll come forward. But it's going to be a long time doing it. But right now we're getting plenty of phone calls. We're trying to do the best we can because the problem, though, is it's such a late stage. If this was cancer, it'd be stage 5. And I don't like that, but there's nothing we could do except plant seeds. And as we plant these seeds, it's a lot of training throughout. The FBI Academy's helping us. Police departments are helping us. And we're just trying to get the word out. We're doing some great stuff on the radio and your help, Jack, and everything else. The awareness, and they've got a call because everybody can help get the help they need. And the thing I'm so dedicated with, Jack, is they saved my life. If it wasn't for the cops, I'd be dead. They came through my house like stormtroopers, and thank God they did, because I wouldn't be around. I'd have never made it. And so I owe my life to the cops, and I'm here to pay them back. When I went through the FBI Academy training on undercover, they said, is there anything you'd like to say? And I said, yeah. Where were you before I got busted? I need to know all this information. I just laughed. I said, I'd be dead now. No, I've got a lot to be thankful for, and it's all around the legal system. That's where I'm at today.
Well, congratulations on your sobriety, and I appreciate you sharing your story and also your willingness to help anybody. But obviously, our audience are in law enforcement and, you know, certainly other first responders. But I wonder if we can go back to something you just said a minute ago about, you know, just sort of about the profile, I guess, of addiction, or maybe the profile of somebody who has an addictive personality. I think a lot of cops have that. And you even talked about eating. And I'd like to maybe expand on that a little bit, because I think sometimes we think if it's not a substance abuse addiction, we don't have an addiction. But they're out there gambling, or they're addicted to sex, or they're addicted to food. You know, there are all kinds of things that affect that personality type. You talk about
exactly.
It being genetic.
Look at your undercover agents, John.
Yeah.
These poor guys, you know, my heart goes out to these guys. That's the guys that busted me. And you take these guys, when they're hanging around busting prostitutes, what are they going to get into? When they're busting for cocaine, what are they going to get into? I mean, they're exposed to it every day, and that's the lifestyle that they have to lead. And, you know, if they're genetically predisposed, good luck.
Right.
This is not their. This isn't by choice. I didn't wake up one day and thought, gee, I think I'll get a couple of beers and wipe out a family of four. You know, we don't do that.
Yeah. Yeah, and yet I think a lot of people figure once they're in law enforcement, they're immune to all the bad problems.
How about the doctors and the nurses?
Right.
Oh, he's a doctor. He should know better than take those pills.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with it.
Yeah.
We don't get a choice.
Let's
the Chinese have a wonderful saying, man takes the drink. Ah, then the drink takes the drink. And, ah, the drink takes the man. That's when I get them.
Yeah. Can we talk about, let's talk about interventions. What do you do? First of all, how do you get people to acknowledge they have a problem?
You don't.
And even when they don't, what do you do to intervene?
What I like to do is I have them call my office. And if it's going to be a family intervention or if it's a police department going to do the intervention, it's up to them. We can do a family intervention. We can do a police intervention, you know, from the chief of police on down or human resources or whatever. And what I like to do with a cop is say, look, if they don't say, hey, I do have a problem, you know, and a lot of times it's because they got a DUI or, you know, they alcohol in their breath when they come to work or whatever. And if it's earlier in the stage, I say, look, there's some problems with your changes in behavior, attitude, achievement, and attendance. You're not showing up, and there's concern. I'd like to be your advocate. But, you know, I don't know if you got a problem or not. So, listen, let me get them off your back. Let's you and I go down, and we'll get a 3 to 5 day evaluation and by the experts, the same people that do United Airlines and Delta, and the cops are the doctors, nurses. Mm-hmm. And then we got it in paper. And if there's no problem, I'm going to come back here with you, and we're going to tell these people to get off our back that there isn't a problem. But I said, if there's a problem, you're going to stay for treatment. Oh, okay. Well, they've been manipulating the whole system for so many years, the family and their peers and the cop, the chief of police and everything else, lieutenants. So they're not afraid of that evaluation. Well, there's experts in there that are going to bust them because you can hold it together for a few hours, but after a while your blood pressure is going to go up and pretty soon they caught you. Plus, you know, your liver a lot of times is going out too. So I like to get a real good evaluation. Then we got something to work off and get them into treatment. Then we're at the mercy of the insurance company on how good the insurance is and how much we can get because this is very expensive treatment. So we got to get the best bang for the buck. And that's where we come in.
You know, as you were talking, I can see a line, you know, that's kind of before it's too late and after it's too late. And I think a lot of people, they don't get into treatment until they've crossed the it's too late line. And I think there's probably like a DMZ in the middle there, where if you're willing to get treatment, you might be able to save your job. You might be able to save your family. Unfortunately, what we hear about a lot of cops when they come to us, you know, they've crossed that other threshold. It's way too late. They've lost their job. They've lost their family. They've got a problem that they haven't dealt with. Can we go back
no
in time
insurance.
A little bit and maybe talk about, you know, what do we do to the people before it's too late? How do we get them to acknowledge they need to do something before they lose everything they've got?
We've got you can't be addict. The disease, the first thing the disease does is take out all logic thinking, all common sense, and most of all, their hearing. So they're not going to listen to anybody, especially the wife or anybody else.
Right.
And their peers are not going to go up against it because they're all drinking together.
Yeah.
So if you're going to tell on me, then I'm going to tell on you. So that's kind of they've kind of blackmailed each other without saying anything.
Yeah.
So that is the way it happens. What we've got to do is educate the families and the human resource department, the police, the cops, or whoever. Watch for the signals, like a car.
Yep.
When the red light for behaviors starts to change, attitudes, achievement, and attendance. Because they used to do all these things. They're always on time. Now they're not coming in on Mondays. They're more and more. It happens with the alcohol or pills. If they got hurt on the job, there they get on pills. We, you know, this is what happens all the time.
So let's talk about treatment, because I heard you say some things that are new. I've certainly heard the same things from Sean Riley at Safe Call Now, but we're looking at a different profile for recovery. We're looking at a longer treatment, 12 weeks instead of 30 days. Let's talk about that. And because I think that the norm out there is 30 days, you're all fixed. And then you use the magic word that I think is the real key here, and that's case management. So let's talk about that a little bit.
What we've come up with is I've got a recipe for recovery, and anybody wants to call me, I'll send them a copy. What I've done is kind of hokey, but I put a recipe for recovery, a recipe for chocolate chip cookies on one side of this recipe. And if you use all those ingredients, you leave it in that oven long enough, you're going to have a wonderful chocolate chip cookie. If you turn it over, I've got a recipe for recovery, okay? And if you do use all the ingredients and you leave it in the treatment center long enough, you're going to have a fine, fine product. And the big thing is, of course, is the early detection, like the cancer people. We're 30 years behind cancer detection, that's for sure. So we're not catching them early enough, and it can't be the addict. He's not going to come in and say, gee, I think I need to go for an evaluation. They're not going to do that. The dial is too big with this disease, and we're really clever at lying, manipulating, everything else. So we've got to have the people aware that we've got to spot it, okay? Yeah. And that's to get the real good evaluation, and then if they need treatment, is a minimum of 12 weeks. If you read the National Institute of Drug Abuse.org, it'll tell you the length of stay is a minimum of 12 weeks. Anything else is worthless. And they tell you the recovery rates, I understand, from my experience, on 28 days an outpatient runs between 3 and 7%. If we can get them up for, like the pharmacist, we've got them for a good evaluation, 12 weeks in treatment if they need it, and then to come home for a minimum of 5 years to be monitored and with the discharge summary of checking their urines, their meetings, seeing their psychologist, their family counselor, whatever it takes. After treatment, they find out what it is, because you're like, the brain is like an onion. You got to peel the onion and find out what's really going on, because there's a lot more going on than the alcohol and the drugs. Yeah. There's a lot of childhood crap. There's all kinds of things. And you got to learn how to deal with it, because if we don't teach them how to deal with these things, and the problems come back up, like trauma or abuse, when those things come up and they're triggered, you're going to use. So our recipe, we're trying to get them for 5 years of monitoring and case management, because that's where it's all at. And the other thing is we've got to treat the family. You cannot take a cop out of a leper colony, put him in treatment, put him back in the leper colony, and say, don't catch leprosy. That's insane. And we've got to treat the family, too. And they've got to change. And the police department has got to be also to where, hey, maybe you need a meeting buddy or something like that. We've got to accept this disease. It's not a moral issue or a big boys don't cry, because that's going to kill people. And a lot of the cops, rather than face that, they kill themselves. That's not right. That's what doctors did. In Oregon, in 1980, middle 80s, we lost 9 doctors because in those days, they jerked their license. The board just jerked the license. These guys thought it was all over, and they killed themselves. That's what's wrong with the cops. Cops are killing themselves worse than the military.
Yeah, it's tough. And, you know, the big issue is they get slipped into the culture, and the culture, as you pointed out, you know, promotes this instead of looking for those red flags or red lights. The other issue, right, I suspect, and I don't know very much about it, but I suspect the insurance industry is part of this, because from what I've heard, we have an awful lot of underinsured employees out there that, you know, when they want treatment, they're not able to get it because their insurance won't cover it.
Well, that's so true, John. And you know what? I'm a person that I don't give a damn. We'll piece it together. The glue in this whole thing, when we get this puzzle together, these chocolate chip cookies, when we're trying to put all these ingredients, the main ingredients is the case management. Yeah. I don't care if he goes to treatment for a day and a half, if that's all his insurance will pay for. If we got the case management and keep him accountable and check his urine and check his meetings and everything else that's on the discharge summary, we can get some success. Not nearly like it'd be if we leave him in treatment long enough for that brain to start healing. Because it's a brain disease, it's genetic, it's handed down hereditary-wise, and we got to let that brain cool off at a minimum. I mean, anybody can hold it together for 60 days, but after that, they start to go, okay, now they start to fess up. Now we can get in and do some real good work. It's a lifetime. I mean, I've got 30 and a half years right now, and I'm still in therapy. I was at a meeting this morning at 7 o'clock. I'm in Santa Barbara now. I didn't lead the meeting today, but I was part of it.
Yeah. Where does case management is kind of a new concept to me. I've been hearing it a lot lately. Is that a component of the medical industry? Is it something your organization does, or people have to hire their own people? Who does that?
We do it. We do it worldwide. We do it for for bands, golfers, athletes. we just hold people accountable. What I found was is if I didn't have a Board of Medicine or a Delta Airlines or United Airlines to back up the pilot, then I have the families or the police department, okay, you're my new Board of Medicine. So okay. If I can have all those people start to understand our disease and then hold these people accountable, then we can get some progress done. But without them holding accountable, they throw them in these treatment centers and come out and say, good luck, be sure and go to your meetings and wave goodbye to you.
Right.
Well, that's like being in a 747 for 28 days and throwing you out the back without a parachute.
Yeah.
The parachute is the case management. Hold them accountable. They might not like it, but who cares? You're going to live. Do you know any disease? The American Medical Association says addiction is a disease. It is in the DSM-5 this year,
yep.
And it's a disease. And I know of no other, in my recovery, 1986, I had a stroke, four seizures. In 1995, I had a heart attack, and they put in a stent and or a balloon. And then 90 days later, they had to put in a stent. The balloon collapsed. In 99, I had a bone marrow for leukemia because my white cell count was low. 2000, I had 8 bypasses. I've had 2 hernia operations, 2 cataracts removed. And I've had pneumonia 3 times. And the only reason I'm talking to you now and still alive is because I'm sober.
Yeah.
This everything that I just shared with you, including the eyes and everything else, are always checked, and I'm held accountable for that I'm in good shape because I have to fight off all the heart problems, the strokes, and everything else. But the only one that they don't check is my alcohol and drugs.
Yeah.
That's insane. It's
yeah.
a chronic disease, has no cure, and here I'm just let go.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate what you're doing, not only for my brothers and sisters in law enforcement, but all the other industries out there, because, you know, you're championing a cause that still has a long way to go.
Oh, boy.
You know, I guess I would ask, what can we do to help you, and what, you know, where do we go from here?
Well, some days I'm just so happy to be in America, because can you imagine, you know, this movement started in 1935 when the 12-step program started. You ought to go overseas if you think we're behind. There's so much. They're another 30 years behind us. But right now, if you model this thing after cancer, what did they do that was so different? My grandmother died of cancer, late stages, didn't detect it. Then the American Cancer Society came out with, we're checking ourselves. I'll bet you when you were showering today and you felt something, I bet you thought, whoa, maybe I better get that checked.
Yeah.
That we can do that with ourselves, but with the denial of addiction, we can't. We've got to rely on other people. So we've got to be better at getting the message out. If we had the money for television, radio, whatever, is watch for these signs and then do an intervention, because I don't know any other way to get somebody into help. And do the intervention just for the evaluation. Because we're not punitive, we're just trying to save somebody's life. But I think the only way we can do it is to follow the cancer people. You know, you see these big pink shoes on the pro players. You see the
right.
pink ribbons on the airplanes. But you don't see much about alcohol and drugs. The only thing
yeah,
you see is a poster of a...
It's a big problem that most people don't want to acknowledge.
With a pretty girl.
Yeah.
We got a long way to go, but... It's people like you that are helping us to spread the message. It's like that little poem or that little story about that kid out of the ocean picking up those starfish and throwing them back in. There are thousands of them. This guy says, my word, son. He said, there's thousands of starfish. He said, you can't save all of them. But the little boy had the one in his hand. He says, yeah, but I can this one. That's the way I feel.
Yeah. Well, I thank you for doing what you're doing. Before we close, why don't you tell us a little bit about your organization and how people can get a hold of you?
Well, we've got a crisis hotline. We're 24/7. Our toll-free number is in the office at 800-386-1695. My toll-free number to my cell is 866-460-9014. And... of course, we've got all kinds of information on our website, which is Southworth, S-O-U-T-H-W-O-R-T-H, Associates, one word, plural, southworthassociates.net. There's quite a bit of information on there. Call us night or day. If it hits my server, the only time I won't answer it, I'll be honest with you, is when I'm in a plane. I do a lot of traveling. I was in Bangkok and Hong Kong last week doing an intervention, and I've got to go to London. Well, I go to Nashville next week, and then I go to London the week after. So and then I've got to go to Istanbul. So we're working all over the world, but my phone rings around the world, and I don't care what time it is. If somebody's in a crisis, let's do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you, John, for what you're doing. I really appreciate it. I appreciate you taking time to be here today. I will take a lot of this information and put it up on our blog so law enforcement people from around the world can find it. And
great.
I thank you very much. Any last thoughts?
No, just the one thing, a lot of people say, John, you know, well, what if I'm wrong? Well, what if I'm wrong about blowing the whistle? If you thought somebody had cancer and you had them intervened on and evaluated and it wasn't cancer, would you say, oh, darn it, he didn't have cancer? Yeah. So what? Just it. You don't want to go to the funeral wishing the hell you'd have done something about it.
Powerful words. Thank you very much, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you all for listening. You've been listening to another edition of Cops Alive Audio Bulletin. I thank our guest, John Southworth, for his time, energy, and commitment today. You can find more about him on our website. And please stay tuned for our next edition. Stay safe and take care.